Okay, we have a lot to talk about today. That may sound like a terrible pun because lot is the topic of the cilia, and indeed it is a terrible pun, but puns by nature have to be bad in order to be good in order to be bad, and that's probably a good stand-in for Lot. Lot himself is clearly a complicated character, and somebody with aspects of good and bad in him, and somebody who has a very conflicted and perhaps bifurcated character. So the idea of being big good and bad at once, or not fully one or the other, is very much to the core of the question of Lot. And his identity is a lot about what this Aliyah is telling us. And that itself tells us a lot about Avram, because the contrast between Uncle Avram and Nephew Lot is also very instructive to us and a part of the message of the parasha overall. So to begin, Leah starts off, V'gam l'lot ha'oleches Avram hayatzom v'akar v'oholim. So right off, Rav Shamshon Ophel Hirsch has an interesting comment here about the trop. That he notes that there's a snachta, there's a pause in the middle of the sentence. So v'gam l'lot ha'oleches Avram. That before telling you what he had, before getting to the point of the sentence, there is this moment of pause. And in essence, it's there to make you reflect and to think, okay, here you have Lot, who has this tremendous internship. He has this tremendous shimush opportunity. And he gets to live life with the future father of the Jewish people, with Avram Avinu, and gets to experience everything that Avram does and to take in all the potential lessons that Avram could be teaching him. So with all that, it must be incredible. What did Lot get out of that? What's the rest of the pasuk? Oh, so Uvakar Vohal. Yeah, he got a lot of property. He got a lot of wealth. In other words, he didn't get the ikar. He didn't really necessarily internalize what Avram's values actually were. He benefited from him, but he didn't get the real crux of what he could have from Avram Avinu, and that's, again, the theme of this Aliyah. Lo nasa osam ha'aretz ha'shevet yachdav, ki haya ruchusham ra, lo yachul ha'shevet yachdav. So they had too much property, and the land couldn't hold them all. He refers to comments again that the reason the land couldn't hold them all is because there wasn't really shalom between them. If they were totally in harmony with each other, they could have shared the space. But because there was developing a lack of trust, so then their property was too much for the space that they had. And this is really reflective of a larger rift. The Rav Soloveitchik, a number of years ago, that published many volumes of the writings of Rav Soloveitchik. It came out after he passed away. So there's a volume in English called Abraham's Journey, which has many of Rav Soloveitchik's shiurim on the whole, the title is pretty self-explanatory, but the whole character and the whole mission of Avram Avinu. And as we noted a minute ago, so to the extent that this parsha, this aliyah is about Lot, it's also about Avram by contrast. So here, this pasuk is indicating to us that it's not necessarily so much about any specific fight, although there was that too, but it's about a distance, about a chasm that was developing between Avram and his nephew, because their values were getting farther and farther apart. And whether or not there was any actual nekudas u'machlokes, whether or not there was any actual subject to argue about, it was becoming more and more clear that there was a basic incompatibility between them. So then, there were actual fights. The next pasuk goes on to say, Vayihi Riv, Bein Roe Mikne Avram, Bein Roe Mikne Lot, Rakhnani Vahaprizi, Oz Yoshev Ar. So there was then a quarrel between the shepherds of Avram's cattle, herdsmen, call them, and those of Lot. And also, should know, Akrani and Aprizi were in the land at the time. So, what exactly is going on there? So, alright, so they're quarreling, they're fighting. And you should also know that the Kanani and the Prizi were there. So salvation is volume Abraham's journey. So he understands that the point is that perhaps Avram would have stayed it out a little longer. It wouldn't necessarily have pushed for a separation, except that there was a public. There were others around who would witness what's going on. And Avram's going to have to take a stand, and he's going to have to publicly debate Lot, and it's not going to be so nice. It's not going to be such a pleasant thing, so therefore, better off, we should be separate. It's also pointed out that, as Rashi notes, that there was the content of the dispute was the issue of Gezel, right, that Lot's animal managers were allowing the animals to graze in lands that were owned by others, and there was this concern of Gezel, and Avram and his staff were trying to convince them not to do this. So the need for a greater separation because of the Kanani and the Prizi being there. So some point out, the Sefer calls them, by an acquaintance of mine has a discussion about this, a few others have along these lines, that it's going to look like a Chil Hashem, that Avram and Lot, they look alike and they're one family, and if this kind of behavior is going on and people are witnessing it, so it's going to look like Avram condones it, like he's a part of it. And that was the Chil Hashem. So that also created a greater rift and a greater need for separation. So the Yomer Avram Elot, Alnach Him Rize Veni Zeinach. So why should we be actually in active quarrel? Uvein Ro'ay Uvein Ro'echa. My people and your people. Ki Anoshim Achim Anachim. So here it emphasized that point. That we look alike, as Rashi says over here, that previously made point that it is hard for people to understand the difference between us, so better we should separate. Hello, kol aretz lefanecha. Hipared ne'ma'alai, hipared na'me'alai, im ha'smol ve'imino, im ha'yamin va'asmi'ilo. So, let's separate, and you pick which way you want to go, whichever way you go, I'll take the other direction. I'll go the opposite. So here, this also is very reflective. There's a lot to say about this. It's Avram who suggests the separation. It says, Yiparina. And this seems to be somewhat at odds with the attitude that we see in Chazal, where they consistently say that Lot wanted to separate. Lot wanted to pursue his own goals, his own materialistic desires, that because he was lustful for things, so therefore he wanted to be separate, to be able to pursue that. So it seems here from the Pasuk that it was Avram's idea. So as they point out, the Rashid of Kambiavner of Goldberg has an essay about this in the Sefer Asufos Marachos, an old essay about Lot's character, where he knows that it's not like Lot is incapable of arguing. It's not like he wouldn't be able to take a different position if he wanted to. But he was waiting for this, that he was looking for an excuse to separate, to remove himself from Avram's Avinu, from Avram's influence, Avram Avinu's influence. And here he jumped at the opportunity. Okay, Max?
I'm not familiar with the Chazals that you've been referred to, but would it not be just as easy to say, like, yeah, sure, Abraham told them to split it, and like, and Chazal would ascribe to vote as sort of like negativity in his choice, like, and you just, like, rather than have to push to say that he chose to split, why can't you just look at that and choose a bad place to go for, like, only because it was, like, pretty, for that paint picture of the character. Right?
Oh, that's certainly a big part of it. That certainly contributes to the picture. But the language of the Chazal emphasizes specifically the Pasuk, L'tayvi Yavakesh Nifra, the one should be separate. So certainly these other details all point also to the same overall picture of his character, but a part of it is not just that he was attracted by the materialism and by the other elements, but also that he did want to separate. So to...
specifically saying he wanted to go...
Right. So the question is how to reconcile that with the language of the Pasuk, where it's clear that it's Avram suggesting it. So they emphasize that, yes, Avram suggested it, but it was something that what was really fasting for. And as soon as he got that opening, so he was eager to pursue this. So the Rashiva in his essay in the Sufas Marachos, so he notes, as we said before, that, and the Pesukim have indicated that Lot has got so much from Avram, but it's not the main thing. He didn't get the main life lesson. He didn't totally miss it, and we'll see that the value of Hachnas Asarchim, other things he did get from him, but the overall orientation that you're here for a purpose, not just to fulfill all of your worldly desires, so that was something that he did not really appreciate, and he did have this materialist focus, and this corrupted his judgment. So he wasn't really able to see things straight and to keep his eye on the main thing. And the Shiva quotes the Medrash that the schus that Lot had to be saved was that he saved Avram's life. How did he save Avram's life? Because when Avram was in Mitzrayim, and he was saying that Sarah was his sister, not his wife, so Lot could have exposed him, could have revealed what the truth was, and that would have been terrible. So we credit Lot for not doing that. Now, if you think about it, that's a pretty low bar. Right? So it's not like he actually provided assistance. It's that he didn't get in the way, he didn't cause a problem that he could have, and again, the problem would have been for his beloved uncle who was taking care of him. So the idea that he should be looked at as such a hero because he held back from endangering Avram's life, why is that exactly a reason to get a medal? Why is that a tzchus that should be what saved his life? So he notes there that you see to the extent that Lot's perspective had been clouded. And he draws there on the often quoted theme of Rav Dessler, Michtav Milyo, where he talks about the concept of Nekudas Bechira. That we have a Yisod, we have an Iker, that man has Bechira Chavshus. That humanity has the ability to choose good or bad. So Rav Dessler noted that, yes, that's true, broadly speaking, but it doesn't mean that at every minute of your life, all options are open to you. Your life decisions will very much impact the range of choices that you have at any given moment. So when somebody is following a negative path and putting himself into a unhelpful context, which is, of course, where we see Lot heading now, so then that shifts the range of choices that individual has. The person decides to put himself in the yeshiva context, so then the spectrum of choices he's going to have is going to be very elevated, and he's not going to be deciding every morning, every spend your days in yeshiva. So it's not like the Bechira Chashis is so broad that when you wake up every morning, you're thinking, okay, so what should I do today? So should I learn Torah all day, or should I rob a bank? And it's not like you're trying to confront those two choices every day. Your range of choices is much narrower because the decisions that you've made and the context that you have taken on for yourself gives you a more limited focus range. personal loads here, we see is in the other direction that he had consistently emphasized his more materialistic side. And therefore, when it comes to what we can look at to praise him and what it is that's going to be a source of success for him, is something which is really pretty unimpressive, something which would not seem like that is such a source of merit. So, Vayisa loved that saying, oh, Vayar, it's called Kikar Hayarding, Kihula Mashka. So Lot looked up, right? So now he is able to follow his desires and eager to look around, and he sees the whole plain of Jordan, and he sees that, wow, it's all very fertile, it's all well watered. Okay, he sees that it's all very beckoning. And here you have foreshadowing that this is before, just so you should know, this is before God, I'm sorry, because I'm on mute for a second. He sees this is all very beckoning. He sees that this is all very tempting. And there's a foreshadowing in the pasuk, very blunt foreshadowing. And you should know, this is before Sodom and Amorah were destroyed, which is going to happen pretty soon. So, yeah, while it's still there, it seems very tempting. Vayivcha lo lot, es kol kikar hayardein, vayisa lot mikadem, vayipardu ishmael achiz. So Lot, he sees this whole plain, and he travels there, and here Chazal have this idea that he traveled mikadem, so that is from God. He traveled away from God. That's what the pasuk is meaning to convey to us. And they separated from each other. Again, that notion of separation, something that Lot is happy to do, even if it was Avram who suggested it. So Avram, Yashav Baritz Kanan, Velot, Yashav, Ari Hekikar, V'ahal Adstom. So he set up his tent, Lot, towards near Stom. So this whole question of the character of Lot and how exactly to evaluate him, I noted one recent Sefer just came out on Sefer Bereishis called Chamuda Yitzchak. He has a whole discussion about how this is the kind of thing, like Chazal say in the beginning of Parshas Noach, Yesh Darshan L'Shvach, Yesh Darshan L'Gnai, that you could interpret positively, you could interpret negatively, that when it says that he pitched his tents Ad stone, like up to stone, or towards stone. So you could see it as a negative, that basically it's a way of saying that he is separating from Avram now, and that brings him closer into the realm of stone. That brings him into their orbit, and that's where he's now orchestrated, that's where he's now looking. While you could also maybe interpret it more positively, that Ad stone, Ad the law of the cloud, that he went towards Stone, but he didn't establish his residence within their environment, because he recognized that to whatever extent he was tempted, but he recognized that they were deeply problematic people, to say the least, and therefore to create some type of separation, he recognized was wise. So now here is a very powerful statement in the middle, and also somewhat of a foreshadowing statement. The Anshei Sdom Royim V'Chatoyim LaHashem Ma'od. So the people of Sdom were very, very bad. They were sinners to a great degree. So clearly that's the way we perceive them, because they are considered irredeemable and incorrigible, as we'll read next week, and indeed they get destroyed. So it's worth taking a minute here to consider what exactly it is that is so terrible about them. And the truth is, they're associated with all kinds of averos in all kinds of areas. And we know that there are aspects of Gilui Arayos that they were associated with. In fact, in the English language, so sodomy is taken as a term to connote certain activities, and we know that they were involved with Avodah Zarah, Chazal tell us. We know that they had all kinds of Averus, Ben Adam L'Makom, and Ben Adam L'Chavero. But there is a certain specific focus within their misbehavior that is particularly important and has halachic relevance. So I think I mentioned the other day that this week we would see some synergy in the parasha, that this is going to connect and supplement our Bava Basra learning. And indeed, that's the case, that there is a very important sugya, which I look forward to learning with you in the first parak of Bava Basra, which draws halachic relevance from what exactly was so bad about Sodom. And it doesn't focus on the Gilui Arayos or on the Avodah Zarah, but on something else. So there is a sugya in the first parak of Bava Basra, which has many, many real-world implications, and implications also halachic and philosophical, that we are told, kofin al midas stom, that we compel, Besdin will compel on our behalf, that Jewish people should not act like the people of stone. The characteristic of stone is something that we have to stay very, very far away from, and that we have to make sure that Jewish people don't do this. So what are we talking about then? So this does have this halachic applicability. So what aspect of stone's behavior is it that the Gemara is talking about? So in addition to the sugyas in Bava Basra and Bava Kama, a few other places where this phrase appears, so the notion of Midas Tom also appears in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, where it's somewhat surprising. It's not necessarily what you would have guessed, that the Mishnah talks about there are people who have different mixtures of attitudes. Some people think that what's mine is mine, and what's yours is also mine. Shali shali v'shalacha shali. And that's not too wonderful. And there are some people who have the attitude that what's yours is yours and what's mine is also yours. That's a very different kind of attitude. But what about the attitude of shali shali v'shalacha shalacha? What's mine is mine and what's yours is yours. So that, the Mishnah says, according to one opinion, is nothing special one way or another. It's the average, the midah beinonis. But according to the other opinion, the Mishnah, harei zeh midas tom. That is midas tom. So what's so terrible about that? Seems pretty reasonable. Okay, you're not a ganav, you're not a thief, you don't want to take the other guy's stuff, but you want to hold on to your stuff. So what's so terrible about saying shali shali v'shalcha shalcha, that should be associated with the worst of the worst, the people who are irredeemable and have to be destroyed? So it seems to emerge from here, it's not just about protecting your own property rights. It's about an attitude. The Bartanura writes in the Mishnah that it doesn't sound so terrible, so maybe it means that that attitude could lead to the Midah of Stone. But others understand it more literally, that that is the Midah of Stone. But that the notion is, it is an extreme aversion to chesed. It's that I don't want you to benefit from what I have. And even if it wouldn't cost me anything, even if it wouldn't have any impact on my life, I still don't want you to benefit. So it's one thing if I were to say, listen, I don't want you to take away my stuff. Say that we understand. But to say that you shouldn't even benefit from what I have, even when it doesn't cost me anything. So that seems to be what we're talking about when we say, midas tom. Now, if this were a different year, so maybe it would spend more time right now explaining the details of the sugya, but because Ford Rav Hashem, saying that, and if this were a different year, maybe we would spend more time going into the details of the concept, but because we look forward to learning the Sugya of Iyun with you, so we'll save most of that for when we get to it, but just to give you a sense of what the Gemara is talking about. So there are a couple of references to Kofi Omida Stone in Shas, and sometimes it's linked with another phrase, sometimes explicitly, sometimes the Rishonim bring it in, but the phrase is, Zenene v'zeh lo chasen, that this one benefits, and the other one doesn't lose anything. Now, what does that mean? So it has different applications, which may or may not be related, and just a preview, because we'll get into the details of the sugya. But, so, one example is that, let's say, somebody, that's a Gemara in Bava Kamma, that let's say you have your property and you find out that somebody slept in your property when you weren't there. They somehow didn't damage anything in any way, but they just benefited from your unknowing hospitality. And you want to charge him after the fact. And you're not a hotel. You don't make money renting out rooms. This is before the Airbnb movement. And you're a regular individual who doesn't make any money for renting out his rooms. So to try to charge him after the fact, the Gemara says you're not allowed to do that. Because, yes, it's true that Zanana, it's true that that individual benefited from you, but you, Lohasir, it didn't take anything away from you. And you're not in the habit of charging for the service. So therefore, there's no legitimacy to collecting payment for that. So the idea that just because this person benefited means that you should be entitled to charge him, so that is not the case. So on the surface, that doesn't seem like the more egregious example. But Mara Boston, we'll see more, has examples which come from the other side of it, that let's say there's a scenario where you're not going to gain either way, but you're more interested that the other guy doesn't benefit. So, for example, let's say you have two brothers who are splitting an inheritance. So they're going to split it 50-50. And it's worth the same. So let's say the two brothers are splitting an inheritance, so it's equal value. So it shouldn't necessarily matter which half you get, except that one of the brothers happens to have already a property that's adjacent to one half. So he will get much more value out of getting that half rather than the other one, because he'll be able to build onto his existing property. So it's potentially more beneficial to him, and to the other brother it doesn't make a difference. So that's an example of Zenene, that one could benefit. And the other one, it's not going to matter one way or another, it's equal value. So to object to that, so the Gemara raises this phrase of Kofin al Midasom, that not proper for a person to want to deprive somebody else of benefit when it doesn't matter to him one way or another. So there's a lot to say about that, so again, a lot to say about this implications, and you have to figure out the circumstances in which it's actually relevant, and every actual application of life is a little bit more complicated, what's really a situation of lo chaser. But that reflects the idea that one of the most objective parts of the Stone culture was the fact that they were completely opposed to chesed. And this is not even necessarily about stealing. It's not necessarily about materialism that is focused on taking away from others, but it's about just being so focused on your own property and your own benefits and not wanting others to be able to benefit at all, that you are completely separated from anything about customers. And that is clearly the polar opposite of what Avraham Avinu was about. that, again, is a big part of the contrast to this parsha, that you see Avram and Sodom represent these two opposites, and the chesed that Avram represents is what makes him, as we'll see in the beginning of next week's parsha, is what makes him the ancestor of the Jewish people, because he's going to teach a path of chesed to his household and to all the future generations. So Sodom, being completely separate from that and completely devoid of chesed, is destined for destruction. So this is a major aspect of what needs to be figured out, and how to understand exactly where this fits in philosophically. Know that, for example, it's often quoted that the Baron Lichtenstein, the Chassadic Lavracha, felt that the writings of Ayn Rand, objectivism, and very much self-focused materialism, was completely anathema, shouldn't be read at all by yeshiva students, or something that was totally opposed to all Jewish values. There's a lot to understand about the various aspects of this, but chesed is such a core element of our, the core element of our identity, and Sodom represents a complete separation from that. And the notion of the midah, it's not just the reality, because there are different factors that could indicate why you do one thing or the other, but it's the midah of not having any connection to chesed that is particularly egregious. You know, the Torah says in Parshas Re'eh that, rather than Shmini Atzeres, that we have an obligation of tzedakah. We have to open our hands to the needy. But the Torah also has negative phrasing together with that, and has two languages of negative. You shouldn't clench your fist, and you shouldn't harden your heart. So that seems to be the way Tosus understands in the Sechel Ksubis, that seems to tell us that not only is there a positive mitzvah to give tzedakah, but there actually are also isurim not to give tzedakah. Apparently two isurim not to give tzedakah. So that's very scary, because none of us are able to say yes to every tzedakah request. So the idea that there is an Isser and another Isser, that it's going to be relevant if you decline to give tzedakah, so that's going to be very, very scary. It's like to say that if you refuse a request in tzedakah, it's like you're eating chazer and wearing shatnez at the same time. You're over on tulav. So how exactly do you understand that? So some understand, and it's kind of a poetic way of saying that you should make sure to give tzedakah. You can imagine like a preacher saying, do not harden your heart, do not clench your fist, open your hands and give, and make sure to help. So it could be that it's a poetic way of expressing this, but it could also be that it's more literal. And there's some who explain, and the language around them sounds like this also in Sefer HaMitzvos, that what the Torah is saying here is that ideally you should be giving lots of tzedakah. But there are circumstances when you won't be able to give tzedakah. And there are contexts in which it doesn't make sense to give. Maybe you're past your limit. You know, the Gemara even says that you shouldn't give too much because you may become impoverished. You shouldn't give more than 20%. So there's only so much you're able to give, only so much you have in the first place, and you're not supposed to give that much of what you have, and there are people who aren't worthy of your trust and who shouldn't be receiving, and there are priorities, and even when you have a tzedakah to give, you're supposed to give to a list of a hierarchy of who to give to. So there's all kinds of legitimate reasons why you would turn down a tzedakah request. There's all kinds of justification not to give tzedakah in any specific case. You know, the Gemara in Ksubas has a statement, seems like a little cynical. That we should give our thanks to the liars. And we're grateful that there are dishonest people out there. that would not fly, we would be sinners all the time, meaning that we would be in trouble every time we said no to a sucker request. But because there are dishonest people out there who might be scamming us, so we could say, oh, who knows, maybe this guy's a scam artist, so I don't want to give him, and I have to be careful. So I can blame it on that. So we're lucky that such people exist. We're lucky that there are dishonest people out there because they can justify how we're not giving tzedakah. But the point being that, yes, there are circumstances where it's justified not to give tzedakah to this specific individual in this specific case. Okay, fine. But what is it that's not justified? What's not acceptable is, if a person clenches his fist, if he hardens his heart, and he says, I'm not giving tzedakah because you're not my problem. And I'm not giving tzedakah because I don't have to worry about you. And that's my reason for not giving tzedakah. So then, that's actually an issue. That's a serious problem. But to not give tzedakah for any long list of good reasons that we can accept. But to say, I'm not going to do it because you're not my issue. I don't have to care about you. My heart is hardened and my fist is clenched. So that's very, very objectionable. So the midah of stone, the idea that shali, shali, v'shalcha, shalcha, what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours, you go take care of yourself, I take care of me, you take care of you, and that's it. So that is very, very objectionable, and that is what we call midah stone. It's also interesting to note, especially it's a Shemitah year right now, and there's a lot to reflect upon, in terms of what are the lessons of Shemitah. So there is a major question one could ask about the various economic philosophies of capitalism and communism, and where exactly the Torah sits on that spectrum. Is the Torah advocating a capital system, or is it advocating a communist system, or is it advocating something else? And Shemitah very much provokes that question, because Shemitah itself, the Shemitah year itself, seems very socialist, very communist. You have to just be mafkir, everything that you have produce-wise, you just have to let people come and take it, and you're not doing actual selling. So there's a lot that seems very communist or socialist about Shemitah. However, it's not the entirety of our economic structure. It's one out of every 7 years. It seems that it's reasonable to say that the Torah advocates a system which has a capitalist core to it. We have a concept of rich people and poor people and private property, and all of the major building blocks of capitalism exist within halacha. And Chazon Ish pointed out that you can't say, like some do, that money is evil because there are halachos that require currency. So the notion of money is something that the Torah clearly expects to exist. So we have a core of a capitalist system, but at the same time, we have to recognize that it has to be modified in order to make sure that the poor are attended to, that there has to be a focus on taking care of the needy within that capitalist system. And if you miss that, so then you're missing everything. Then the whole picture falls apart. So there are some svarim that point out various commentaries on Chumash that suggest that it's interesting. I remember by Yitzchak Lau wrote an article for Tradition many years ago, where he did a very thorough survey there of the rabbinic literature on capitalism and communism. And he points out there different interpretations of our parsha and last week's parsha of how the stories are understood in the context of this question. So it's interesting, there are some who saw Stone is kind of a communist kind of society, that everybody is cut down to size and everything is kind of equal. It's an interesting take, but there are those who saw it in a very different way. And he quotes there, some who see the need for the balance between aspects of capitalism and aspects of communism. And that last week's parsha and this week's parsha represent a pendulum swinging back and forth in ways that aren't so helpful. So, for example, in the beginning of Parshas Noach, so we know that Chazal explained that what led to the Mabul was Gezel, essentially, was people either outright stealing from each other or finding ways to more subtly steal from each other. So it was a focus on materialism in a very destructive way. And that could be seen as an extreme capitalist kind of attitude, that everybody is out to get money, and that led to their society falling apart, and that they had to be wiped out. And then by the end of Parshas Noah, so you have the tower, so the pendulum swings to the other extreme, and you have a society that seems more communist in its structure, and it's all about this one big joint project to challenge God and to de-emphasize any individuality. The Midrashim there say that when a brick would fall, they would cry at the loss of the brick, but when a person would fall, they wouldn't care about the person. So the pendulum would fall in the other direction when they get to the Migdal Mavah, and then when you get to Parshas Lechacha and you get to the stone, so now the pendulum has swung again to a negative form of capitalism. It's different than Dor HaMabul. It's not necessarily about them stealing from each other, but it's about this very rigid delineation of what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours. And there's no room for any kind of chesed. There's no room for anyone taking care of each other. So it's different types in Parshas Noach. Again, the pendulum swinging back and forth in ways that are extreme and in ways that are not good for society. And that is a part, perhaps, of the message of what's going on in these parshas. Okay, so again, the ins and outs of the sugya of Kofron Midas Tom are very important. I look forward to learning that with you in the next future, in the near future. Let's just read toward the end of the Aliyah here. So, Hashem Amar, Abraham, Akra, he parted, Moshe, Imo, Zonre, Nachor, Reina, Malka, Mashiach, Hashem, Safona, Vinegba, the Kedma, the Yama. So look up your eyes, now Lot is gone, and so Avram is able to refocus on his mission. He doesn't have this negative influence. And God says, lift up your eyes and look up and down everywhere. Look north, south, east, west. All of this I'm going to give you. Be like a dust of the earth. I'm going to give it all to you. Be a hal Abraham, be abo. So Abraham built the mizbeach, and the first comment here that every time his mission becomes clear, he builds another mizbeach. He acknowledges his gratitude for clarity, and there is a reference. The Or Chaim notes that when God tells him to look around and to see, Or Chaim says this was a huge nace, this was a huge miracle that he was able to have telescopic vision, and he saw everything at once. He saw the whole land, north, south, east, west. He was able to see it all in one view. And this is Simcha Zosel Broid, the Sefer Sanderach, as he points out, the reason for this nace, why did God have to make such a miracle? Because to make the point that one needs to have the total perspective in order to understand what we're talking about. And of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is able to take everything at once, is able to have that complete sweep, to have that complete perspective. And that was what was necessary for Avram to be able to understand how this fits in and to have that clarity about his mission as he continues now in a purer form without Lot as part of his picture. Okay, so we will stop there. I wish you all a safe and healthy, wonderful Shabbos. Again, those who are ill should only be better. Those who are healthy should stay healthy and get stronger. And we'll discuss how exactly we will set things up for next week on Sunday. Shabbos should be only good things. Have a great Shabbos. Thank you.